Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1175, titled Donovan's Brain. This is being recorded on March 8th of the year 2021. The title of the program is something of a pun. It alludes to, well, not a pun, but it is humorous in a way. It alludes to both a 1953 movie starring, by the way, then Nancy Davis, later better known as Nancy Reagan, in a sci-fi thriller about a man named Donovan who is killed in an automobile accident, and a scientist saves his brain, which then begins taking over people and bending them to its will and forcing them to commit criminal acts. That reference is also to William Wild Bill Donovan. He was the head of the Office of Strategic Services, World War II's, America's World War II Intelligence Agency, and he exerted profound influence on both the corporate landscape, the world of espionage, and, as we will see, the world of the underworld prior to his service with OSS and afterward as well. One of the things that we're going to be looking at in this program is the relationship between what is conceptualized as the overworld, namely the world of business and so-called respectable people, and the world of criminal enterprise. In turn, we will also be taking a look at the relationship between corporate America, its functionaries in the world of diplomacy, and some of the fascists and criminals, both in the corporate world and in the underworld, who have been inextricably linked with the American power structure. This is May 8th, International Women's Day, and so we're going to start by taking a look at a remarkable paper by a professor at Harvard Law School called J. Mark Ramseyer, R-A-M-S-E-Y-E-R. He is, by the way, the Mitsubishi Professor of Japanese Legal Studies at Harvard Law School, Mitsubishi being one of the zaibatsu, the huge Japanese corporations that were the backbone of the Japanese war effort in World War II and really were one of the dominant influences in bringing fascism to Japan and also its war of aggression. The zaibatsu also wield tremendous power today, not only in Japan but around the world, including in the U.S., as we will see. Noting that J. Mark Ramseyer is, again, according to his Wikipedia entry, the Mitsubishi Professor of Japanese Legal Studies. We read about Mitsubishi from the remarkable book Gold Warriors, that by Sterling and Peggy Seagrave. Mitsubishi's market position at the war's end in 1945 was described by a Western economist as being equivalent to the merger of U.S. Steel, General Motors, Standard Oil, Alcoa, Douglas Aircraft, DuPont, Westinghouse, AT&T, National Citibank, Woolworth Stores, and Hilton Hotels. That is an impressive array of business interests. And then that was, again, that was equated with Mitsubishi's position, market position, at the end of World War II. Mitsubishi, again, wields tremendous influence in the contemporary world and apparently has helped to mint Professor Ramseyer's career at Harvard Law School. I mention that because Professor Ramseyer has come out with a couple of pieces of revisionist history. One of those has maintained that the comfort women, the slave prostitutes employed by the Japanese military from 1904 through the end of World War II, were volunteers who were maintained by private enterprise. That is rather like saying the people who died at Auschwitz were accident-prone. And also Ramseyer, again from his Wikipedia entry. Also in 2021, Ramseyer emerged at the center of controversy over a forthcoming chapter in the Cambridge Handbook of Privatization from Cambridge University Press. Writing on the Great Kanto Massacre, in which thousands of resident Koreans in Japan were murdered, Ramsayer depicted the Koreans as, quote, gangs, unquote, that, quote, torched buildings, planted bombs, and poisoned water supplies. That, again, is remarkable. The Kanto Massacre occurred after the 1923 Great Kanto Earthquake in Japan, which wreaked tremendous damage, and the despair of the Japanese population was basically harnessed by the Japanese authorities, including powerful elements of the secret police and military, who then initiated an anti-Korean pogrom in Japan that killed thousands of people. So for Professor Ramsayer to depict the Koreans as gangs that torched buildings, planted bombs, and poisoned water supplies, is again basically he is channeling the spirit of Japanese reaction and fascism. Note again that he is the Mitsubishi Professor of Japanese Legal Studies at Harvard Law School. About his revisionist portrayal of the comfort women, we read from Asian American News, or ASAM News, of February 22nd of 2021. Harvard professor claims World War II sex slaves volunteered, this by Lindsay Wang. A paper from a Harvard professor received widespread criticism for concluding that those recruited as comfort women did so voluntarily rather than being forced into sexual slavery, the Harvard Crimson reports. Many Korean media outlets have pointed out the paper's author, J. Mark Ramsayer, received the Order of the Rising Sun from the Japanese government in 2018, speculating that there was undue influence on his paper. Ramsayer has denied such allegations. Sankei Shimbun, a conservative, nationalist Japanese newspaper, featured the paper prior to its publication in the International Review of Law and Economics Academic Journal. Various legal scholars and historians from both South Korea and the U.S. have spoken up about the historical and logical inaccuracies in Ramsayer's paper. In For the Record 1140, we went into the issue of the comfort women, again accessing information from the seminal book, Gold Warriors, America's Secret Recovery of Yamashita's Gold, by Sterling and Peggy Seagrave. It is one of those essential books, to coin the term, with a capital E and a capital B. And again, if you have not read that book, I would go so far as to say you cannot really understand the modern world. In Gold Warriors, the Seagraves write about the truth concerning the comfort women, and it is at fundamental variance with what Professor Ramsayer has said. Worst of Japan's slave programs was that of the comfort women. Young girls, many not even 13 years old, were shanghaied into sexual slavery. After the war, Tokyo insisted that all comfort women were merely prostitutes who volunteered and that the entire operation was run by private enterprise. That is the line basically peddled by Mark Ramsayer. The Seagraves go on. Both statements are demonstrably false. After talking about the inception of the comfort women program in Japanese-occupied Korea in 1904, they say, by 1932, the Kempei Tai resumed full control. A typical military brothel had 10 barracks, each divided into 10 rooms, plus a supervisor's hut, all enclosed in barbed wire to keep the women inside. Rural brothels were tents, while railway cars were fitted out as mobile brothels. Korean and Japanese yakuza provided brutal security. Fees were based on a woman's ethnic origin. Japanese girls were top-rated, followed by Koreans, Okinawans, Chinese, and Southeast Asians. Later, Caucasian internees were added. Commissioned officers paid 3 yen, non-commissioned 2.50 yen, privates paid 2 yen. Bookkeeping was thorough, with forms for each woman listing daily earnings and number of clients. Up to 200,000 young women and adolescent girls were forced into this sexual slavery to serve more than 3.5 million Japanese soldiers. Each was expected to have 15 partners a day. Theoretically, they received 800 yen a month minus cost of food, clothing, medical care, soap, and water. And again, that is in contrast to Professor Ramsayer's treatment of the comfort women, and also basically his revisionist position on the Great Kanto Massacre. Moving again, that Ramsayer is the Mitsubishi Professor of Legal Studies at Harvard. It is worth taking a look at Mitsubishi, by the way, the maker of the famed Zero fighter plane that gave the Japanese Air Forces air superiority in the early part of the Pacific War. A great many Allied soldiers, including Americans, died at the hands of the Zero, or died in combat with the Zero, I should say. Again, noting what the expert in quoted in Gold Warriors said about Mitsubishi. Mitsubishi's market position at the war's end in 1945 was described by a Western economist as being the equivalent to the merger of U.S. Steel, General Motors, Standard Oil, Alcoa, Douglas Aircraft, DuPont, Westinghouse, AT&T, National City Bank, Woolworth Stores, and Hilton Hotels. And noting again, that Ramsayer received the Order of the Rising Sun from the Japanese government in 2018 and basically has echoed the official Japanese line about the comfort women. We note the following. Professor Ramsayer would appear to be in some very prestigious company, no pun intended. The Zaibatsu continue to wield tremendous influence in the contemporary world, Japan in particular, and the power politics discussed in the book Gold Warriors by Sterling Seagrave and Peggy Seagrave talks about the influence of the Zaibatsu on the American political landscape. They write, "The real issue is conflict of interest. During the Clinton administration, U.S. Ambassador to Japan Thomas Foley was adamant in rejecting compensation for POWs and other slave laborers, insisting that, quote, the peace treaty put aside all claims against Japan." By the way, that peace treaty was negotiated by John Foster Dulles in 1951. More about that in a minute. Foley's deputy chief of mission, Christopher J. LaFleur, echoed this dogma at every opportunity. It was a matter of some interest to victims that Foley's wife was a well-paid consultant to Sumitomo, one of Japan's biggest Zaibatsu conglomerates, heavily involved in wartime slave labor and a target of the lawsuits. The moment Foley ended his tenure as ambassador and returned to America, he signed on as a paid advisor and lobbyist to another huge conglomerate, Mitsubishi, one of the biggest wartime users of slave labor. Of greater significance, perhaps, is that LaFleur is married to the daughter of former Prime Minister and Finance Minister Miyazawa, one of the three Japanese who secretly negotiated the 1951 treaty with John Foster Dulles. And again, that treaty put aside, according to the interpretation of not only Thomas Foley, but many others, put aside all claims against Japan. We talked about that treaty in For the Record program number 1142, among others. One more time, resuming with the Seagraves account, Miyazawa also is considered by Professor Lossier and others to be the financial overseer of the M Fund. Conflict of interest does not seem to be an obstacle in diplomatic appointments to Tokyo. The M Fund, by the way, or Marquardt Fund, one of the many funds that utilized tremendous amounts of looted Japanese war gold, so-called black gold, and that in turn helped to retain the structure of fascism in Japan, and also was used to finance covert operations by the U.S. around the world. In For the Record 446, there is good discussion of the M Fund in the in that program titled Funds, F-U-N-D-S, and Games. So note that Foley's wife, Ambassador Foley, who was claiming that the American POWs and other slave laborers had no claims, valid claims against the Japanese corporations, note that his wife was a well-paid consultant to Sumitomo, and that as soon as he left his position as ambassador, he became a lobbyist and paid advisor to Mitsubishi. And it is as the Mitsubishi professor of law that J. Mark Ramsayer holds forth at Harvard Law School. And note that Christopher Lafleur, the deputy chief of mission, is married to the daughter of former prime minister and finance minister Miyazawa, who negotiated the treaty with John Foster Dulles and is also considered to be a financial overseer of the M Fund. More about Thomas Foley from Gold Warriors. After retiring as ambassador and returning to Washington, Foley openly became a paid lobbyist for Mitsubishi Corporation as a member of its advisory panel on strategy. Mitsubishi was among the biggest employers of American slave labor during the war. It would appear that corporate power does indeed exonerate, at least officially, a great deal and a great many in the contemporary world. So when we see the corporate influence of Mitsubishi, and I don't think this is unfair, looming at the very least in the background of Professor Ramsayer's legal career, and we should take that into account in connection with not only his receipt of the Order of the Rising Sun Award from the Japanese government in 2018, but also his altogether creative takes on the Kanto Massacre and the Comfort Women. Well, I think that type of relationship, and the type of relationship that we see between the Zaibatsu, Sumitomo and Mitsubishi, and Christopher Lafleur and Thomas Foley, and the fact that Christopher Lafleur is married to former Prime Minister and Finance Minister Miyazawa's daughter. And Miyazawa, an apparent overseer of the M Fund, was one of the people who negotiated the 1951 peace treaty with between the U.S., between the Allies and Japan, negotiated by John Foster Dulles of Sullivan and Cromwell. Prostitution, of course, is in most of the world still illegal, and certainly slavery is illegal, but within the world of tremendous corporate power, both can be realized. The title of the program, Donovan's Brain, again, alludes to William Donovan, or William Wild. Bill Donovan, a powerful corporate lawyer whom we looked at in, among other programs, For the Record 1009. As a corporate influencer and man about the world, Donovan dined with a young Adolf Hitler in 1923 and apparently was quite sympathetic to Adolf Hitler. William Donovan is described at length in the aforementioned book Gold Warriors by Sterling and Peggy Seagrave. Again, one of those essential books, and one of the books that I would suggest is fundamental to a viable understanding of the world that people live in. If they haven't read it, they should. And I would suggest that they will not understand the world in which they live until they have read that. Someone who exemplifies and embodies the marriage of powerful transnational corporations, including and especially those that play a role on Wall Street, and their counterparts in other countries, and the underworld, one could view corporate America and the transnational corporate world as the overworld. There is a fundamental relationship between the overworld and the underworld. And when the overworld decides to cross over into what is traditionally the world of the underworld, they generally do so with impunity. And note that there has been a continued effort at covering up the truth concerning the comfort women, as we note here on International Women's Day. Unfortunately, Professor Ramsayer has served to echo and reinforce the official Japanese obfuscation of the true nature of the comfort women. In the book Gold Warriors, there is an excellent discussion of the world of William Wild Bill Donovan, and they describe him as America's original man in black. And by way of taking a look at the relationship between the overworld and the underworld, and in turn between criminal activity like dope trafficking and outright murder, and the supposedly respectable corporate interests that manifest in the corridors of power in this world, we're going to take a look at what the Seagraves say about William Wild Bill Donovan. And this really is Donovan's brain. Speaking of American organized crime kingpin Meyer Lansky, Lansky, in turn, was closely associated with top CIA banker Paul Helliwell, H-E-L-L-I-W-E-L-L, also based in the Bahamas, who created the chain of CIA black money banks throughout the world, including Castle Bank in the Bahamas, Nguyen Bank in Sydney and Honolulu, and BCCI, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, now said to be reincarnated as Pinnacle. Helliwell's ultimate boss during and after World War II was Wall Street attorney and former OSS chief William Wild Bill Donovan, who also was the boss of Alan Dulles, William Colby, Bill Casey, and others who later became heads of the CIA, and an intimate friend of Meyer Lansky. Quote, almost every key man in the OSS had direct connections with large international industrial and banking interests. Among those listed as having been key OSS executives were Julius Spencer Morgan and Henry Sturgis Morgan, sons of the late J.P. Morgan, who were special assistants to William Wild Bill Donovan. The frontman for Helliwell was banker General Earl E.R.L.E. Cox, C-O-C-K-E, a Grand commander of the Knights of Malta, to which Donovan and many other OSS and CIA brass belonged, which was in turn closely linked to Vatican secret services. Knights of Malta, also, by the way, called the Sovereign Military Order of Malta, or SMOM. Knights of Malta membership is dominated by a reactionary European aristocracy and Americans whose names read like a who's who of the Black Eagle Trust. That, by the way, is the combined Nazi and Japanese war loot that was used to not only buttress the post-World War II financial order, but in particular became a cornucopia for U.S. covert operations. Of the names of the SMOM, former OSS Chief Donovan, former CIA top brass William Colby, John McCone, William Casey, George H.W. Bush, James Jesus Angleton, and Vernon Walters. Also on the roster were General Douglas MacArthur's intimates, General Charles Willoughby, and General Bomber Fellers. Last but not least, former Secretary of State Alexander Haig, who negotiated the 57 in Tokyo with the help of the first President Bush, described in Chapter 9. By the way, the strange case of the 57s we spoke about in For the Record program number 501. And about William Donovan, the sea raids continue. Donovan was the chief spider, America's original man in black. It was Donovan working behind the scenes with John J. McCoy and the Dulles brothers who set up the global network of secret funds and black banks that made creative use of the Black Eagle Trust and laundered drug profits before they entered U.S. banks to bolster the American economy. This was racketeering on a global scale run by covert agents of the U.S. government with proceeds so huge, the only way to hide them was by claiming national security was constantly at stake. Far more effective than two sets of accounting ledgers, national security kept everything off the record. To protect BCCI, Nugan Hand, and other black banks, people were murdered, including Frank Nugan, journalist Danny Casolaro, and former CIA director William Colby, legal counsel to the black banks, whose body was found floating in the Potomac River estuary in 1996. Like the careers of the Dulles brothers, Donovan's life wove gold, drugs, espionage, underworld, and global politics together using personal connections. In 1923, he was a little-known assistant U.S. attorney in the state of New York who became friends with super-rich Albert Lasker, L-A-S-K-E-R, one of the heads of the General American Tank Car Company, which had the first patent for a welded petroleum railway tank car without rivets and dominated the shipment of Rockefeller petroleum on Harriman railways. This, plus Lasker's tight family connections with Germany and his financial cronyism with most of the robber barons, allowed him to introduce Donovan to all the right people. With Lasker's encouragement, Donovan became a celebrity when he and Federal Bureau of Narcotics agent Ken Euler cracked a major drug ring in Buffalo and made a huge drug seizure in Canada, making America look virtuous just before the 1924 Geneva Opium Conference. The seized drugs were traced to the Golden Triangle with the borders of Burma, China, Laos, and Thailand meet. Lasker introduced Donovan to the Rockefellers and Harriman's. Euler introduced Donovan to FBN chief, that's the Federal Bureau of Narcotics chief, Harry Anslinger, who got his job as drug czar because he married the niece of Coolidge Administration Treasury Secretary Andrew Mellon. Mellon was one of the robber barons who had set up the Federal Reserve System. Mellon's son-in-law, diplomat David K. Bruce, later helped Allen Dulles, Anslinger, and Donovan organize the OSS. The OSS was practically a Mellon family enterprise. Once OSS was set up, Donovan became heavily involved in opium and heroin, mingling narcotics with espionage during World War II. He learned a lot from the Brits. In China, he worked with the special operations executives William and John Keswick, K-E-S-W-I-C-K, of Jardine Matheson, Britain's biggest opium cartel in Asia, with a controlling interest in the Hong Kong and Shanghai Banking Corporation, and ties to the Oppenheimer family through the giant mining firm Rio Tinto Zinc. HSBC was one of the major, that's the Hong Kong Shanghai Banking Corporation, was one of the main repositories of Santa Romana's gold and has blocked all efforts by his heirs to access to it. By the way, this is talked about in, among other programs, for the record, 688, Darkness in the Vault. So, this is about attempts at reclaiming some of the black gold. Continuing. Together, Donovan and the Keswicks arranged deals with Kuomintang spy boss General Tai Lee and his underworld business partners. Drug lord Zhu Yuesheng. So did Commander Mary Miles of SACO, the Sino-American Cooperative Organization, set up by Donovan's old friend Navy Secretary Frank Knox as cover in China for the Office of Naval Intelligence. Their currency in covert operations was drugs, gold, and diamonds. Donovan also set up a special office in OSS called X2, which spied on foreign insurance companies, many of the biggest being in Nazi Germany. His partner in running X2 was Cornelius Starr, capital S-T-A-R-R, who started out selling insurance in Shanghai in 1919 and went on to build American International Group, AIG, into one of the largest insurance companies on Earth today. Early in the war, Donovan sent James Jesus Angleton to Rome as chief of X2 and other OSS black operations in Rome. Angleton paid Sicilian and Calabrian mafiosi to smuggle OSS agents into Sicily and cross the toe of Italy. In appreciation, Angleton and Donovan put Sicilian gangsters in positions of political leverage in Palermo and Rome and kept them supplied with gold and guns. In America, the Mafia helped government agents keep an eye out for Nazi spies along the Atlantic and Gulf waterfronts, on the understanding that when the war ended, Mafia dons currently serving time in federal penitentiaries would be freed and, quote, deported, unquote, back to Sicily. In effect, Donovan and his circle of intimates wove a web linking the underworld in Asia, Europe, and America to U.S. banks and the U.S. government. This would pay off richly during the Cold War. In 1946, when the OSS was shut down by Harry Truman to be succeeded by the CIA, Donovan pretended to resume private practice as a Wall Street attorney, but in reality spent most of his time helping Paul Helliwell set up black banks to make use of the Black Eagle Trust. To disguise these post-war operations, Donovan founded the World Commerce Corporation, or WCC, with financial backing from the Rockefellers, particularly Nelson Rockefeller. One of WCC's main objectives was to buy and sell surplus U.S. weapons and munitions to foreign underworld groups like the Chinese and Italian mafias in return for their cooperation against communist and socialist political parties or labor unions. Author Douglas Valentine called it a sort of private Marshall Plan, a cross between, quote, an import-export combine and a commercially oriented espionage network, unquote. To maintain secrecy, the WCC was registered in Panama. Many of its operations involved the nationalist Chinese in Asia and Sicilian and Calabrian mafia in Europe. The nationalist Chinese provided the hard drugs, and the Sicilians moved them into the U.S. through Meyer Lansky in Havana and Santo Traficante in Tampa, or through Mexico to Bugsy Siegel in California. Mixing drugs and espionage in Italy, Donovan and Angleton forged a three-way alliance with the Mafia, the post-war Christian Democratic Party, and the Vatican. New York narcotics boss Frank Coppola was recruited by New York narcotics boss Frank Coppola was recruited to be Donovan's liaison with Sicilian godfather Salvatore Giuliano. In May of 1947, paid by Donovan and provided with guns by Coppola, Giuliano's men murdered 8 people and wounded 33 in a Sicilian village that had made the mistake of voting for Communist Party candidates. Coppola's main mission was to get mafiosi into the Christian Democratic Party and the party's deputies in the government while eliminating rival communist candidates, killing them if necessary. Their reign of terror was so successful that by 1948, Italian communist boss Palmiro Togliatti accused the U.S. of subverting Italy's elections, not the first or last time that accusation was voiced. The point here is that it was not strictly a CIA operation. It was a Donovan operation supported by the CIA, and Donovan's World Commerce Corporation, or WCC, had been set up with Rockefeller money. Where do you draw the line? In Asia, Donovan was a registered agent of the Thai government, creating an alliance between the disgraced nationalist regime on Taiwan and crooked Thai generals. Together, they moved opium and heroin out of the Golden Triangle, bypassing old French channels of the Union Chorus, which had gone through Laos and Vietnam. To dominate the Asian drug trade, remnant nationalist Chinese armies stranded in southwest China crossed the border into Burma, where they seized control of the Golden Triangle. They were lavishly supported by Washington on the pretext that they were carrying out guerrilla operations against the Chinese communists. These Kuomintang forces became the main movers of drugs into the international market, aided by the CIA airline Air America and the CIA shipping line Sea Supply, set up by Helliwell and Donovan. Air America was dreamed up by Donovan and old China hands William Pauley, Whiting Willauer, W-I-L-L-A-U-E-R, and General Claire Chennault. In the 1930s, Pauley had set up the Central Aircraft Manufacturing Company, or CAMCO, for Madame Chiang Kai-shek to assemble planes for what were later called the Flying Tigers. Pauly was paid lavishly by the Chiang regime, the Sung family, and drug lord Du Yuesheng. We'll talk more about the Sung family in programs to come. We'll talk about them in, for the record, 1142. Continuing. In 1950, Donovan and William Pauly brought, one more time, in 1950, Donovan and Pauly bought out Chenault, having persuaded the China lobby to pay him $5 million for his beat-up airline. Pauly then retired, unquote, to Havana, where he went into business with Meyer Lansky. He spent lavishly buying sugar plantations, an airline, and a bus company. When Fidel Castro seized control of Cuba from the Batista regime, Pauly escaped to Miami, where he continued his alliance with Lansky using a Miami bus company as his front. Meanwhile, Pauly helped Donovan persuade right-wing Texas oil man H.L. Hunt to support the Kuomintang regime with millions of dollars for covert operations. Valentine points out that Pauly and Donovan were aided in all this by the CIA's Alan Dulles, Admiral Charles Cook, Ambassador William Bullitt, Brooklyn publisher M. Preston Goodfellow, former Special Operations Agent William Keswick, and Sepiris Fasoulis, F-A-S-S-O-U-L-I-S, Vice President of Commerce International China, a subsidiary of Donovan's WCC. Donovan kept up his close ties to General Chenault, and former Flying Tigers physician Dr. Margaret Chung, said to be a key link between the Kuomintang drug generals and Bugsy Siegel. While the China lobby insisted that all narcotics came from communist China, the Kuomintang's General Tuan and General Li assured us over dinner in Chiang Mai that they were the ones moving the drugs, us being Peggy and Sterling Seagrave. Continuing, we observed their opium-laden mule trains, trucks, and planes, and airdrops over the Gulf of Thailand to waiting Taiwanese cargo and fishing vessels. One of Donovan's top financial allies was Helliwell's frontman General Earl Koch, whose family had been in banking for generations. After World War II, Koch served in the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund as head of the American Legion, but also on the board of CIA banks such as Nugan Hand. In April of 2000, just 2 weeks before he died of pancreatic cancer, General Koch agreed to give a legal deposition to the attorney of six plaintiffs who said they had been swindled by former intelligence agents of the South African apartheid regime. The scam was typical of many rackets run under a part of the Black Eagle Trust called Project Hammer, in which unsuspecting investors were encouraged to put up money for projects in the Third World, which then collapsed, swallowing their money. In this deposition, reproduced on our CDs, General Koch said he knew a lot about the Black Eagle Trust Project Hammer, because he had been a part of Donovan's spider web for decades. He testified that by the 1990s, he knew personally that Project Hammer had assets exceeding $1 trillion. Koch testified that no Project Hammer transaction could take place without the personal approval of Citibank CEO John Reed. General Koch explained that Reed was, quote, the cheese, unquote, the big cheese boss or overseer of Project Hammer, quote. I had no problem seeing the President of the United States, but I could never get in to see John Reed, unquote. Reed was third in a string of Citibank CEOs groomed by Donovan, each the mentor of the next, starting with George Moore, who was an OSS agent during World War II. Rising quickly to head Citibank after the war, Moore trained Walter Wriston, W-R-I-S-T-O-N, as his replacement, who in turn trained John Reed. Ties between Citibank and the CIA were always close, and a number of top spooks joined the bank when they left the agency, such as former DCI John Deutsch, who left Langley under a cloud to immediately become a member of Citibank's board. John Reed, who denies knowing anything about Project Hammer, has since left Citibank, also under a cloud, and is now head of the U.S. Stock Exchange. It is curious that in the 1990s, while Reed and Citibank were being sued for moving $50 billion in Santa Ramona's gold from New York to the Bahamas, and General Koch testified that Reed was overseeing Project Hammer with assets of over $1 trillion, Citibank claimed to be going bankrupt. It was not the only player in the game of musical chairs by major banks, as various Rockefeller holdings absorbed each other, and their offshore holding companies like hungry amoebas. Well, this again about William Wild Bill Donovan and his intricate and incredibly powerful covert post-war spider's webs, so to speak. And it is William Donovan who really embodies and exemplifies the clandestine marriage of tremendous corporate power, national security power, and traditional underworld activities like trafficking in drugs. So when I talk about this program as being Donovan's brain, really it was Donovan's brain that exemplified, did not create, but exemplified and greatly amplified the type of marriage of the overworld and the underworld that we see looming in the background of Mitsubishi Professor of Law, J. Mark Ransard, who may not even be aware of the nature of the power that influences his scholarship. We're going to conclude this program by taking a look at another individual who embodies the marriage of the overworld and the underworld. This is someone we have spoken about in the past, and that is Kodama Yoshio. In past programs, I have referred to him as Yoshio Kodama, but actually the proper Japanese iteration of his name would be Kodama Yoshio. Now, Kodama Yoshio, along with Sasakawa Roichi, a man who was self-described as the world's richest fascist, and as we looked at in, among other programs, for the record 970, was very close to the Mitsubishi Corporation, the Mitsubishi Zaibatsu. Messrs. Kodama and Sasakawa were both key members not only of the early unification church and extension around the world and through the decades of the Japanese patriotic and ultranationalist societies, but they also were key players in the world of post-war Japanese war gold. As we will see, Yoshio Kodama was not only a Japanese war criminal, but also one of the major post-World War II kingpins in the drug traffic, an individual whose activities were sanctioned by the Emperor of Japan and whose activities overlapped the realm of the Emperor, and who also, while doing all of these things, was in many ways the CIA's main operative in Japan. So, someone who exemplifies the marriage of the overworld, the underworld, and the national security establishment, we now talk about Kodama Yoshio. Speaking of post-war underground funds that were used to reinstate the Japanese fascists in Japan and to finance U.S. covert operations, another source of underground funds was Kodama, who was reported to have amassed some $13 billion in war loot for his personal use. That, by the way, is $13 billion in World War II dollars. That is an unbelievable sum of money. Again, another source of underground funds was Kadama, who was reported to have amassed some $13 billion in war loot for his personal use. This included two truckloads of diamonds, gold bars, platinum ingots, rhodium, copper, and other vital materials. In order to curry favor with MacArthur's men, Skuka and Bunshun said that Kadama turned the rhodium over to SCAP, that is the military occupation government of Japan. In Tokyo Journal, John Carroll states that the war's end, quote, Kadama had a good portion of his valuables transported to the vault of the imperial family in the imperial palace, unquote. Despite his lifelong involvement in murder, kidnapping, drugs, and extortion, Kadama is said to have been regarded by Emperor Hirohito as a true patriot, possibly because of the great sums he generated for Golden Lily. That was the World War II looting of Asia. Continuing. This may explain why Japan's top gangster was permitted to hide some of his loot in palace vaults. But it goes deeper to include narcotics. In the spring of 1945, Kadama made a quick trip to Taiwan to see that its many heroin factories were dismantled for return to Japan, along with remaining stocks of heroin and morphine. On his return, Kadama was assigned to be a special advisor to the emperor's uncle, Prince Higashikumi, Higashikumi, who served as Japan's prime minister briefly at the start of the U.S. occupation. One more time. On his return, Kodama was assigned to be a special advisor to the emperor's uncle, Prince Higashikumi, who served as Japan's prime minister briefly at the start of the U.S. occupation. According to Kodama's own memoir, immediately after the surrender, Higashikumi had, quote, two or three of us counselors arrange a meeting and, secretly unknown to his cabinet ministers, Higashikumi visited General MacArthur in Yokohama, unquote. Kadama provides no details of what transpired at this meeting or whether he accompanied the prince. Kadama then spent 2 years in Sagamo prison as an indicted war criminal, but was magically released in mid-1948 when he made a deal with General Willoughby, MacArthur's top intelligence officer, to give the CIA $100 million, equal to $1 billion in today's values. This payment bought Kadama his freedom from prison and from any prosecution for war crimes. The money was placed in one of the secret slush funds controlled by the CIA station at the U.S. Embassy. Subsequently, Kadama was put directly on the CIA payroll, where he remained for many years until his death in 1984. Tad Schultz of the New York Times wrote, quote, Kadama had a working relationship with the CIA, unquote. Chalmers Johnson said Kadama, quote, was probably the CIA's chief asset in Japan. While literally an employee of the U.S. government, Kadama continued to oversee Japan's post-war drug trade. Heroin labs were moved back not only from Taiwan, but from North China, Manchuria, and Korea. Chinese, who had collaborated with Japan in drug processing and distribution, were given sanctuary and began operating from Japanese soil. Two of the three major players in Asian narcotics soon died. Nationalist China's General Pai Li was assassinated in the 1946 plane crash. Shanghai Godfather Zhu Yuesheng died in Hong Kong of natural causes in 1951. Kadama was left as Asia's top drug lord while on the U.S. payroll. This could have been embarrassing, for Japan's dominant role in narcotics was widely known and undisputed, but the Cold War hush descended over it like an Arctic whiteout. During the occupation, U.S. propaganda characterized Asia's drug trade as exclusively the enterprise of leftists and communist agents. In truth, it was dominated by Kodama in Japan and by Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek through the Kuomintang opium armies based in the Golden Triangle, who were under the direct control of the Generalissimo's son, Chiang Ching-kuo, the Kuomintang chief of military intelligence at the time. These two top KMT opium warlords in the Kuomintang opium warlords in the Opium Triangle, General Tuan and General Li, spoke to us openly of this. It's also worth noting that Kodama Yoshio also bankrolled much of the liberal, was the prime bankroller of the Liberal Democratic Party in post-World War II Japan. The LDP has held power in Japanese political life for all but about 4 years in the early 1990s. So again, when we look at Yoshio Kodama, we're looking at someone who was one of the top drug lords, really in the pre-World War II, World War II, and post-World War II period, and yet enjoyed the good favor of the Japanese emperor and the CIA, and was an individual who was no stranger to corporate power as well. In For the Record 1142, we looked at the fact that Kodama Yoshio and John Foster Dulles, who negotiated the 1951 peace treaty, were in Seoul, South Korea, on the very eve of the outbreak of the Korean War. It's unclear what they were doing. It is noted, though, that Kodama Yoshio provided not only Japanese Yakuza, but also former Japanese soldiers who fought in World War II to fight on the side of the U.S. and South Korea in the Korean War. So again, when we think of things like prostitution, which in most countries continues to be illegal, and we see the whitewashing of the Japanese role in the Japanese use of comfort women, really from 1904 through the end of World War II, by a professor of law who is the Mitsubishi professor of law, Mitsubishi chair of law at Harvard Law School, it really should not come as too much of a surprise. We see those same corporate interests exerting dominance in the machinations of the U.S. diplomatic corps, and people like Thomas Foley, Christopher LaFleur, hobnobbing with Sumitomo, with Mitsubishi, and in the case of Christopher LaFleur, marrying the former finance minister Miyazawa's daughter. Well, it is one big happy family, I guess one could say, and the machinations all exemplified, though by no means, were minted by Bonovan's brain, hence the title of this program. This concludes For the Record program number 1175, Bonovan's Brain, being recorded on March 8th of 2021. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.